Welcome. Welcome back to Studio Secrets A to Z. I'm your host, Anthony J. Resta, and we have a very special guest. He's become a dear friend of mine. He's an incredible producer, songwriter. You know him well as the lead singer of Chicago for 30 years. Here's Jason Schiff.
Well, Schiff. Hello there.
Yeah, good to have you, man. I've been trying to get you on for a while, and I'm just thrilled to have you.
I've been playing hard to get.
Yeah.
No, but you're persistent, so
yeah,
you know what?
No, I wasn't going to give up.
You did. For anybody who's listening, that's not really true. Well, Anthony asked me, and I said yes, because Anthony's unbelievable, as you all know. What you just played me again, man. Let's make this about you. the sonic sense that you have is just unbelievable. So anyway,
well, thank you so much. I mean, we accidentally wrote a song together just from a conversation we had. How long will it take and how much will it hurt? And we will circle back.
Okay.
I'm going to hold you to it. But, you know, Jason is just one of the most gifted singers, and he's worked with some of my heroes, like, you know, David Foster. There's just so much to talk about. You know, a lot of times I start these from like, oh, where did you grow up and stuff like that. But I'm going to kind of start in the middle, and I want to hear about how you ended up singing for one of the greatest bands in the world and replacing Peter Cetera. How did that happen? Tell me the story of how you ended up in that position.
Well, as you and I were talking before this got started, it's really cool to be right here in Laurel Canyon, which was the beginning of my life in Los Angeles. A lot of friends were up here, and a few of them still are. But the vibe, this is taking me back to when I was here and just had zero idea that I would end up doing what I've done so far. I'm a bass player. Naturally, I played, you know, a lot of the, I started on piano when I was probably 6 or 7 years old and realized, you know, that it was a natural thing, you know, and my best friend up the street, his mother was a piano teacher, and so I'd go up there to their house, and my buddy Danny Pritchard was playing Peer Gynt Suite in the Hall of the Mountain King, you know, Edvard Grieg. Right?
Yep, I love that song.
And I picked it, I watched him play it, and I learned it. And his mother saw that and called my mother and said, your son has a gift. You should get him piano lessons. She was a little advanced for me, so got me a piano teacher, and I, the John Thompson Red Book, right? Kindergarten, which was the easiest. Ba ba da 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 da. I could sight read that. That was easy. And then once it got to first grade, where it got a little more challenging, my piano teacher, Mrs. Johnson was her name, she would give me the assignment, and of course I would do what I always did, not practice it, not look at it. She'd come for the lesson and say, okay, play this for me, and I'd try and sight read it and stumble through, and she goes, no, it's like this, and she'd play it, and then of course I'd play it. She says, oh, I see what's going on here. And I've got to say, you know, thank you, Mrs. Johnson, because she, you know, I've heard stories of teachers that get brutal with students, and she pulled my grandmother, who was the piano that we had was at her house, and she said, so I want to talk to you guys about something. Jason, you need to make a decision. She said, you have a strong gift of your ear, but you're not doing what you're paying me for. So you need to decide, do you want to really learn this my way or yours? And she goes, your way is perfectly fine. It's a great path to go. And I said, I want to do it my way. She said, awesome. So I got the green light to just, you know, seriously, I wish I would have disciplined myself to start studying, to learn how to read. I've actually started later in life. I'm the last several years, and we'll get into that, through Victor Wooten. But that was the beginning. And so I would play piano. My parents had split up when I was about 3 years old, so I come from a broken home. And when I found music, that was the magic elixir, as for all of us, right? And even as listeners, you know, that there's just something about that being a medicine. Music is the medicine. And I found when I was playing piano, and Danny and I would be doing duets, and ironically, we were playing duets. We played Georgie Girl. Yeah. We played Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, and we played SWAT, the theme song from SWAT, which I found out was Michael O'Mardian recently.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Oh, it's we got to get into that.
Funny
stuff.
How the dots get connected when you look back on your life. And so Danny and I would play, and it made people happy. And that was the beginning of seeing that this gift that we have is beneficial to the world. And so it started with that, went into playing. We got guitars. You know, my brothers are all very musical. And so we got some guitars. My brother Darren got a drum set. So we were all goofing around with stuff. And by the time I got my first bass guitar, I was 14, but I was playing bass on a guitar, the top four strings, with my first band in sixth grade that I put together with Danny Pritchard and Dave Dram and Doug Hall were the band members.
Wow.
And I ended up on bass because they all scooped the other instruments up first, but I loved the idea of bass because my father, as you know, we were talking about, is one of the greatest bass players that ever lived, and there really wasn't a lot of connection to him because my parents had split up, like I said. He had gone on to L.A., and he was Elvis Presley's bass player.
Which is just legendary for how many years? I mean, he was the guy.
Right, through all the Vegas years until Elvis passed. But he was up here as a first call session. He was like in the Wrecking Crew stable. So it was Carol Kay, Joe Osborne, and my father was in that rotation. So he made a lot of records up here.
Wow.
And so there was this longing to have, you know, my father in my life, and so I liked becoming the bass player.
Sure,
of this
it was
band.
Like a connection to your dad.
And as I was playing bass on my little first electric guitar that I got, I could tell Anthony that I was playing bass parts. You could just tell that the function of what I was doing. So by the time I got my first bass guitar instrument at 14 years old,
you were already playing bass.
Yeah, it played itself. So I put it in my hands, had a gig immediately. My mother had a band, and I joined her band, joined the Musicians Union at 14, and have never stopped working since then. She pounded on me from day one, "You gotta sing." I'm going, "I don't wanna sing." So I'm a kid, right?
Yeah.
Didn't realize that truly I was gonna be a tenor voice for the rest of my life, but you know, when I was trying to sing, there was no support because I was trying to sing low, and I just thought it was silly, you know, and it was not natural. You know, the bass was natural. I wanted to do, and I tell this to kids, you know, all the time, work on something that's not just natural for you. If you can, like, start, you know, expanding what you do, then you'll become more and more valuable. So she kept pounding on me, sing, sing, sing. And I just wanted nothing to do with it. And so I joined some bands that were of my, you know, my peers, you know, when I was 14 or 15 years old, some rock bands of, you know, the guys my age, and we had such a good time. One of them was a band called Coco Blue that had Todd Howarth, who ended up playing with Fraley's Comet,
okay,
Ted Nugent, Cheap Trick. So Todd is a real versatile, great singer, guitar player, keyboardist, and ironically, we were related because my grandmother's sister, when her husband passed away, when she passed away, so it would be my grandmother's brother-in-law, married Todd Howarth's grandmother, whose husband had passed away. They were like family friends. So Todd and I joined this band together, and we were like, you know, we were not blood related, but we were cousins, right?
Wow.
It was the coolest thing. So I'm singing one song in the band. I think Rock and Roll All Night, Kiss, right? Yeah. It was like a joke, you know?
Yeah.
And moved to L.A. And, you know, shortly after that, at 16, I quit school.
Wow.
And like I said, I actually, my first gig was I joined this band, the People Movers, in San Diego. I'm 16 years old. Nathan East was the bass player.
Holy cow.
So he leaves to come up to LA to become Nathan East. He was doing sessions for Barry White during the day and driving back to San Diego, which you'd never be able to do now with the traffic, to make his club gig. So the People Movers was the best gig in town. Was the coveted gig. And here's Nathan East leaving town. And my mother had taken me to all of her friends in these clubs, and John Ozen was the band leader who had this gig for like centuries, it seemed. Yeah. He was the guy in town, paid the best, steadiest work, right? And so my mom would take me into these clubs when I was 14, 15 years old and say, can my son sit in with you? And they'd like, oh, okay, that's all right, Linda. That's kind of cute. And then I'd play and they'd go, oh, okay, this guy can play. So John remembered me, but when Nathan left, I was too young. So he hired this other bass player that didn't work out. So I had left school, went to Seattle for a gig with my buddy Sam Barris of San Diego, the Barris Brothers. And so I was officially out on my own, was successful as a club musician, and I knew that I was going to be able to. So music is the medicine again. This is the North Star. Yeah. Now you know that you're going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know, you're taking care of yourself. You're making a living. And so when that gig was done, I was headed back to L.A. to live with my mother because she was living there. I got to L.A. and she said, keep going. You got to go to San Diego because this bass player hasn't worked out for John Ozen, and he wants you to come and audition. So I went down there and I walked in and he said, well, I know you can play, but can you sing? And I said, or do you sing? I said, no. And he said, well, you have to because Nathan sang. I go, oh, okay. So I'm going, I just want a gig, right? And he says, so what do you want to try? And something happened that, again, I love to share with up-and-comers, that I did something that I didn't realize was going to serve me for the rest of my life. I didn't know to be careful. I didn't know to try and be safe and limit myself. I'm going, I'm not taking this seriously anyway.
Yeah.
He's trying to get a gig. He goes, well, what do you want to try? So I'm looking at his set list and I go, oh, how about Just the Way You Are? Don't go changing to try and please me. You never let me down before. The rangiest.
Every key.
Yeah. And I'm going, so I hacked through it. And I know I didn't like blow his mind, but he saw potential, made me sweat it out for a day, and then told me, you have the gig if you want it. That was the beginning of the singing.
Wow.
I still wasn't taking it really seriously, yeah. But the amazing seeds that were planted was that I was put in this band with a girl named Moki Graham, who was a superstar in San Diego.
I know that name.
Yeah, she's been up here too. Phenomenal presence and just the voice. So I'm getting chills talking about this dude because it's literally like the preparation for everything that happened. I'm standing next to an icon, and she's not looking at me like, I can't believe that they're throwing this kid at me. Nurturing. She was like really nurturing, and I know I wasn't blowing their mind as a singer. It's funny, when I listen back to tapes now, of course it was there, you know,
yeah.
The confidence was, but a sound and a phrasing
was
there. Obviously there. That's why things were starting to happen. But Moki was really very sweet. She left, and then Pat Hawk, Tony Hawk's sister, joined the band, who. To this day, we're still great buddies. She became my girlfriend, older woman. It was incredible, man.
And what, you were 16?
I was 17, and Pat was 30.
Oh, my gosh.
And I met Tony
it's
when
the
he...
graduate.
Dude, she... But we were the same age, man. Yeah. To this day, it's music, and just completely saw eye to eye. And I remember meeting Tony when he was just getting signed to his first contract at 13 years old, right?
Wow.
Oh, it was incredible. Just this awesome moment in time where it was really starting to take off. And again, I'm singing, but not really taking it seriously. So I get to L.A. I finish that. I basically went as far as I could go. And by the way, the drugs were kicking in too,
oh, sure.
Which we can get to.
Yeah.
So I went as far as I could there, came up to L.A., played top 40 till the cows come home, could always get a gig, no problem. You know, I was listening to the radio so much.
So you're singing all the time?
Well, no, yeah. I was playing all the time. Okay. Now, I'd sing a song or two, but I was not a guy they were hiring to be the singer.
Gotcha.
And I met two true child prodigies when I got here, Tom and John Keane, who I'd seen on television. And these guys were off the charts. So I was feeling pretty good about myself down in San Diego, the big fish in the small pond. Oh, this hot kid, the young kid. When I met the Keane brothers, they eclipsed my talent. First of all, Tom Keane was like this, you know, right next to David Foster. David Foster's second production was the Keane brothers.
Oh, wow.
Right? So Bill Champlin, all of a sudden this circle is starting to, you know, to
heavy
form
hitters
in my life. So I met these kids who I remembered thinking when I saw them on Dinah Shore or Mike Douglas back in San Diego when I was coming up. I said to my mother, if I could meet these two kids, I bet we'd make great music together. And that was just such a fantasy. I'm going, this will never work. They were two of the first people I met when I got here.
That's crazy.
So I joined their band. Tom's father is Bob Keane, who was Delphi Records, discovered Richie Valens and Bobby Fuller. So when you see La Bamba, the movie with Lou Diamond Phillips, Bobbo is their father.
Wow.
It was so wild how... And he was not happy that those kids, because they were breaking away from him, that when they were child stars and Bob was their manager, but Tom was breaking out on his own. Phenomenal, dude. The records that he was making and his voice.
I have to check some of that stuff out.
We should put something on. I'm going to play you something that's just mind-blowing to hear this kid. And so I'm not going to be singing next to this. This is real stuff, man. So I'm just the bass player, and I'm hanging with Tom and John. And so I'm meeting David Foster for the first time.
Oh, my gosh. What was that like?
Through them. It was incredible because he had just produced The Tubes. The Tubes, man.
That was a big album, too.
Exactly. She's a Beauty, that record. And there's Champlin again with Bobby Kimball. And I'm getting closer and closer to this circle through these kids. And my mother tricked me. She kept hammering on me, you got to sing, you got to sing. So she tricked me by getting me a vocal lesson for my 21st birthday.
Wow.
So this is 1983, right?
Yep.
And the trick was it was expensive, so I couldn't blow it off. I'm like thinking, here she goes again, just the total stage mother, just throwing, you know. So I said, okay, I'll go. It was with the great Seth Riggs.
Very famous guy.
The vocal coach of the 80s. Michael Jackson, all the Earth, Wind & Fire guys, Barbara Streisand.
No, he's famous. I know his name right away.
Right. Everybody. He was teaching everybody. Stevie Wonder, this is the guy. So I walk in thinking he's going to be going, okay, here's another stage mother throwing their kid at me, and we'll get this over before it even begins. And Anthony, I have most of my recordings of my lessons with him, specifically the first one. And to hear you finding out who you are is unbelievable. To this day,
that's incredible.
When I literally can hear myself going, you know, and this guy, he says, what do you want to do? I said, I want to increase my range. He goes, well, you've come to the right place. You know, he's got a big booming voice. That's what everybody wants to do. I said, but I want to go down. I know I can sing some high notes, but I want to, you know, Jeffrey Osborne, his record was out, and I wanted to sound like that and tough, like a man, right? And I said, I want to, you know, strengthen my lower register. So he goes, okay. And so to hear this lesson, I'll play a little bit for you.
I'd love to hear that.
A little later, man. To hear this lesson and hear him taking me through some exercises, and then all of a sudden he hears it. That's not me. He goes, all right. So he'd take me up. It probably wasn't that high on the first one.
Yeah, but
he goes, okay. And to hear it played back for you all these years later, he goes, you're barking up the wrong tree, Jason. He goes, you're a tenor. He actually didn't quite call me a tenor yet. because as I hear in the lesson, that was a scary thought.
Yeah.
And he even told me, he goes, don't tell people you're a tenor. Tell them you're a lyric baritone so that you can sing in this range that's comfortable for you, but then you can pop up into these notes and they go, whoa, that guy's got range. But he lit me up. And I went into that lesson thinking, this is going to come and go before it even starts. And I left there thinking, not only am I coming back, but how often? And I started a steady, definitely weekly lesson with him that lasted probably about a year and a half.
Life-changing. I mean, that...
Big time.
Yeah.
And that's the beginning of it all.
That's like
technique. If you, yeah. So that getting the reps in, and when you would think, how long after that did you become the replacement for Peter Cetera as the tenor lead vocalist of Chicago? I would go, well, that's got to be like 5 years. It was like 2 years.
Wow.
Year and a half, 2 years. Getting the reps in, getting the technique, going and recording and starting to feel the mastery of being in the studio as a vocalist.
Sure, working the mic, everything.
I just wanted to be like my dad and be a first call bass player, but it wasn't happening. But boy, as a vocalist, and right off the bat, Champlin. And so there's Moki Graham standing next to an icon. I'm standing next to Bill Champlin. And he's pulling me into his background vocal session dates immediately because we had a blend and I was fast.
Yeah, because you had an ear. Yeah.
That was the thing. But the technique, the whole thing, it's like everything I always wanted. And then some, you're a front man too and a lead vocalist. So my mother was right.
Wow, that's just incredible that you owe that debt to her. I mean, that's just
oh, yeah, she's
forever.
Still around too. And
that's wonderful
and
to hear.
And knows who I am, so it's great.
That's
you know?
Wonderful to hear. What about playing bass and singing at the same time? That's a crazy, crazy thing. Like, I mean, that's
funny,
not an easy thing to do.
You know what's funny? You know Steve Ferroni.
Of course.
Very well. And he doesn't toss roses, man. It's to get a compliment out of this guy.
I know.
And not that I want it.
Yeah.
I can tell he enjoys playing with me. I hire him for my shows, my solo shows, Jason Chef Band, symphony dates, and we're in a band with Jay DeMarcus of Rascal Flatts called Generation Radio. So we play a combination of Rascal Flatts, Chicago, and Tom Petty.
Oh, that's super cool.
Brought Steve into it. And so you don't need somebody to be going, oh, you're great, man, some L.A.,
yeah,
jive shit, right? Oh man, you're great. No. You can tell, you know. And we just did a cruise recently, and they were asking, you know, we did an interview, and the guy asked him, you know, tell me about Jason. And it was uncomfortable. I'm sitting right next to him, and he's said this before. Somebody at a recent gig said, I love this. They're sitting there backstage and they look at me and they look at Steve and they go, Steve, is Jason the best? And I go, oh, please don't ask this guy that. And he said, and I love this about him, he's not going to say, oh yeah, man, you know. He said, I'll tell you what, and this is where you realize what he meant by this, and this means the world to me. He goes, I'll tell you what, Jason is tied for the best singing bass player that I've worked with Hamish Stewart. And I went, wow, man, what a great compliment. The late, great, rest in peace, Ricky Lawson came to see us, Chicago. And another incredible compliment I got was from Ricky Lawson saying, man, what you're doing at the same time is just so great. He goes, your diction on the bass. And that, whoa, to me said, okay, so you're not just sitting there making that secondary. No, it's very important to me. And it's funny we're talking about this because, and not, here's shameless plug, I'm actually right in the process of pulling the trigger to put my membership site together of training.
Sure.
And my whole ultimate value is, you know, I've got a bass course that I've constructed. I've got a vocal recording course. I've got a songwriting course. So it's all under one umbrella. We'll get into this.
That's really important
in a while. But really, the ascension, if people want to learn, you know, like literally beginning bass all the way up to singing and playing, because that is an area that's very comfortable for me. And by the way, when Ferroni says something like he's tied as the best with, you know, well, there's Sting and there's Geddy Lee, and so that's a nice compliment and everything, but but the truth of the matter is there's not a lot of people up there in that.
No, there's not.
I mean, on that level. So it's like, it's funny. I'm very cautious and hesitant to put myself in that caliber. But the truth is, and again, I like to tell this to and this is my mother's point. Sing.
Yep.
You stacked. I tell my kids this. I say, they're both very talented, just like yours are. And I say, here's the deal. Work at what you're not natural at. I'm telling you, you're super gifted. And it's really easy to take your foot off the gas pedal, but here's the difference. If you put a touch of discipline into what you have and you stack the odds, you are in an elite category that is such a small percentage, and you want that.
That's amazing.
You want to be in a very small pool of choices.
And this is the kind of advice that's one of the reasons why I have this podcast, is to share this kind of information, because it's like, it sometimes the things that you think are obvious are not obvious.
And I totally agree with you.
What you're talking about is like that small percentage of people who push the uncomfortable part of their talent to new heights. And you know, I can relate to that, because in the past 3 years I started studying counterpoint and learning, you know, how more about orchestra music and composing for film and stuff. And it's not easy, and it's uncomfortable, and like that, when it's uncomfortable, that means you're going in a good direction, you know?
So, couldn't agree with you more. That's why I started working on my reading. And Victor Wooten at his camp, Victor's one of the masters of taking concepts and making them very simple. I'm sitting there with his teachers, and I said, okay, I know this is like late in the game, and what does it really matter? But I'm just curious, you know, and I love to learn. I want to work on my reading. So where do I start? What do I get? And I'm expecting them to go, oh, go get this book, and this will like take you in it. One of his teachers said the greatest thing. They're all sitting around. I said, so where should I start? And the guy says, read. And I went, well, what do you mean? Read what? And he goes, anything. He goes, think about this. When you're born, reading is, it's impossible for that to be natural. You may be born to be able to play, but reading is, you start looking at symbols and that become words, and just the repetition. I said, wow, that is so profound. So I got the Louis Belson rhythm book first,
yep,
to just start looking at the patterns.
Yeah, rhythm.
And Will Lee's a good friend of mine, and we talked about this, and he goes, here, dude, he goes, look at the notation of songs that you know, and you'll start seeing what those figures are. And he goes, I'm going to send you one. So he sent me this sheet music, and sure enough, remembering what the bass part was, it was Deja Vu.
Okay.
Dionne Warwick, that, yeah, Will's playing bass on.
Wow. He's a monster, huh?
Jeez. But don't to see that written out, I go, oh, that's what that looks like.
That, yeah, now you know. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it takes, and the weird thing is, you know, I started notating. I've been doing these Beatles tours with Todd Rundgren and Christopher Cross and Mickey Dolenz and rest in peace, Denny Lane, who we just lost.
Yeah.
And so the first one that I did in 2019 was the White Album, and so typical me.
With Todd?
Yes.
I mean, Todd's another one of my heroes. We're going to get into this.
I adore him.
Tell me about that whole experience.
Oh, it's the best. But to finish the thought about the reading.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is I said, typical me. So here's another message to a younger myself and anybody else who's coming up that's got a gift of an ear. You know, that hadn't really studied reading, as I said, okay, I'm gonna like procrastinate like usual,
yep,
and shed this stuff towards the end, because I'm pretty good at that. But all of a sudden realizing that there's a lot of stuff on the White Album that's kind of nonsensical, and,
yeah,
odd time stuff that's John Lennon that doesn't quite make sense. So
yeah, even Helter Skelter is not an easy
buddy. Thing. A yeah. lot of that. So I went. So I started putting the record on and just kind of playing to it. And then I went, wait a minute, let me just, in my cryptic way, try and write some of this out. So it started with literally just like straight lines, no note
yeah.
to the bottom of it, but just straight lines that just show me, which is obviously, okay, these are eighth notes or whatever they
yeah,
are.
Yeah, just some notes.
And then all of a sudden I go, okay, this is anticipated. So I just did this little weird slash going into the next bar,
which is like a big band chart, really,
you know. So it just it just showed me. Then I went, wait a minute, no, I need to remember this is an eighth anticipation or a 16th, right? So I went online and I go, well, just show me what the symbols look like, what are the flags, and so, you know, to show me an eighth and a 16th. And then it just kept growing into, let me really notate this out. And so I started and then caught fire, and I was so interested in it, got a program. It wasn't Sibelius, it was something else that I was just starting to notate this stuff out, getting more and more comfortable with the fact that I had notated this out, which I talked to other guys that say, that's how you learn how to really internalize it, when you sure. write it out.
Yeah, because it's like connecting.
It's a whole different thing. Yet, once I went into rehearsals and tried to read it, it was a disconnect.
Yeah.
And my ear went back to, I'm stumbling here.
Well, and also you're looking at like figures from like one of the greatest bass players of all time, Paul McCartney.
No, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I didn't do that.
Yeah.
I didn't write the parts out.
Yeah.
No, it was literally just.
No, but still, just the fact that you're trying to learn these parts. Like,
I wasn't though.
Yeah. Okay.
It's funny. That's another great conversation, because I felt. And it's funny, because the original guys we worked with are phenomenal in their world. One guy was Joey Curatola, who's phenomenal. He's the, I don't know if he still is, but he was the musical director and the bass player. He was playing Paul in the Broadway production Rain.
I know his daughter. She's sang here.
Yes,
before.
Exactly.
Therese, she's amazing.
That's right. So Joey was in it. Phenomenal. A guy named Darren Murphy from Austin that Christopher Cross brought in, phenomenal. He played John Lennon on Broadway.
Yeah, high level.
That Yoko tapped him, you know, great singer, such a Beatles aficionado. So we all get into rehearsal, and my thought off the bat was, I could tell that these guys are used to recreating this stuff verbatim. And I'm looking at Todd Rundgren, Christopher Cross, Mickey Dolenz, myself, going, how much time do we have, and does it really make sense to try and recreate these things? And so I'm keeping my mouth shut in the rehearsals. But then I heard it and realized, in my opinion, we're going to sound like idiots if those of us that are the artists, the featured artists on this thing, are trying to recreate these songs. You guys, the musical director, and they're fantastic, you do that. But if I'm going to be trying to recreate it, it's going to really fall short. And it's just my opinion. It may be wrong or outvoted, but I felt the same way about the rest of the guys, that you got to make it yours somehow. So it's funny, because the second time we did it, Denny Lane was on it, and there was a discussion about learning the parts, and I basically said, I'm not going to. I'll do, if there's something super iconic.
Right, it's going to be obvious to you.
Then I will do that, but I am not going to recreate these parts verbatim, because I don't believe that that's the best. And Denny Lane stood up and says, I have to agree with him, man. I was in a band with Paul McCartney. We didn't learn the parts. That's Wings.
Yeah.
Denny Lane. Ferroni, he was in a band with George Harrison.
Yep.
They didn't learn the parts verbatim. I get it. Rain, all that stuff, that's what that is.
Yeah.
Recreate it. But for this, and we came to a beautiful, happy medium, you know, of discussing this stuff, that, so a long-winded answer to your...
No, it's really interesting.
That I did not write these out learning the parts.
Well, think about this though, like from your whole life as a bass player, from a kid to now, like, there's no way that some influence from Paul McCartney hasn't already sunk in there.
Well, here's the fun part about that. And I was just thinking as you were saying that, I'm going to play in that spirit. I'm going to play, you're not going to hear the exact notes, but you're going to hear a feel and you're going to hear a spirit that is very Paul McCartney in this. And so when we were out on tour for this, I was doing interviews and they would ask me, so what was your Beatles moment growing up? And I said, truthfully, I'm too young. I did not experience that because I'm, you know, I was born in 1962. So when that was really happening, that was not, I found it later. But here's my goodbye. I said my Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band moment for me was Goodbye Yellow Brick Road.
Yeah.
Elton John. That's what launched me. That record and that summer is what turned me into, this is where I'm headed, where a lot of people say it was the Beatles. And so, Dee Murray, Elton's bass player, one of my first massive influences. And all of a sudden I went, that's Paul McCartney.
Right.
Fluid, lyrical. Then I started thinking, Chicago, Peter Cetera, Paul McCartney, these guys were Beatles freaks. I go, now I'm starting to see what my DNA is made from. I didn't see it as it first happened, but I go, of course it's that.
It's an evolution. Did you play with the pick a lot or do you mix it up?
Big time.
Yeah.
Not growing up, but all my years in Chicago, I would mix it up, man. I would play all styles, finger, slap, pick, maybe all in one, the same song.
Yeah, wow. Did Peter Cetera play with a pick too?
He played with a pick. I don't know if he was...
I know David Foster is really fussy about bass players and bass parts, and he probably likes the control of the sound you get with a pick because it's a lot easier.
Well, David, as he's said many times, most of the records he's made, he didn't use bass players. He was playing synth bass
right.
on it. You know, yep. So he's, you know...
A master.
You know... I think on Chicago 16, I'd heard, because that's Cetera playing bass, that...
They put it in a synclavier, probably.
No, it was really him.
Okay.
I don't know if I don't think the synclav was out yet. That was 1983, so it was like shortly after that Fairlights and synclavs came out.
Yeah.
So, but Chicago 17 was all pretty much synth bass, is David Foster. And on 18, my first album, I played on my song, and so that was the only song that had a bass on it, and so I played bass on my tune.
Do you remember what it was like recording with David Foster?
Phenomenal. He hired me to come and play on Neil Diamond's record he was producing after that.
You know how his signature, you know, use of really cool chord inversions where he has the fifth as a root sometimes.
And the third.
And
very
the third.
Classical.
Yeah.
It's funny, I went back during the pandemic and really just started listening to a lot of Baroque, you know, era music, and I went, whoa, wait a minute, Chopin. It's like, I thought David invented these things. No, man.
Yeah.
Some of the most beautiful moves that Foster does is pure Chopin and Beethoven, man.
That's so cool.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah,
yep.
I'm really interested in that. And I'm always in awe of some of those reharmonizations he does, like on those Chicago records where it's all of a sudden there's this big break into the outro where it's like, dun, 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 you know those things?
Big time.
And it's like, what the hell
is
that?
I got to experience a couple of those on Chicago 18. There's If You Would Have Been Faithful has got a couple of those little surprise
modulations.
Yes, it's just phenomenal.
It's just like, what are you on, dude? I mean, and that stuff is used a lot in, and I talked to David Rigsby, who's a choir director at our church. Those turnarounds that they do in hymns, like before they go to the last round of the hymn, there's a lot of that. And it's like, whoa, it's like the five of the five, the subdominant, median. It's like insane. It's like, and they just do it. You know, it's like they don't like analyze the Roman numerals like we would do trying to figure out how the hell they're doing it.
No, it's beautiful.
So guys, this is going to be our first cliffhanger. We've got a multiple episode here with Jason, and some of the stuff he gets into with David Foster in Chicago is just going to blow your mind. So settle in for part two next time. We'll start off with playing one of the hits he sang on. In the meantime, please go to our website, check out our new tabs on, you know, consulting stuff. If you want to have your mix evaluated or a song, some input on an arrangement, anything, we're doing that stuff now. And also, please like and subscribe everywhere you can. And we'll see you next time. This is Anthony J. Resta signing off. Studio Secrets, A to Z.